Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 10th, 1995, and in the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is David Peters, and he will be talking on environmental ethics and law, the case for granting legal rights to natural objects. So let's move to the fireside room, and David. What I'd like to have us think together about today on a number of different levels is a proposal which was advanced some 15 years ago or so by a University of Southern California law professor by the name of Christopher Stone. And he wrote a long article in the University of Southern California Law Review, typical of law articles. I don't know if you've read any of these things. I mean, there seems to be some legal rule that you can't write a law review article under 60 pages and 400 footnotes. With everything you say has to have, have to have the evidence for it and everything. But this title of the article, which was then paperbackized, made into a book, was called "Should Trees Have Standing?" Well, see, it's a little double entendre here. We talk about stands of trees, but as a legal person, he is asking the question, should trees have legal standing, albeit legal standing to sue? And the thrust of this proposal, as it runs over some 60 pages, is to offer an argument as to why natural objects, exemplary of what we're talking about with things like rivers, forests, entire ecosystems, species, as to why entities like this should be, by our legal system, granted legal standing to sue, that is, be capable of functioning as plaintiffs in court suits suing human beings and organizations for harms done to them as the kind of entity they are. Just to cut to the chase, if he has his way, for example, we could have court cases which look like this. The Colorado River versus the National Park Service. Now, what's the gripe of the Colorado River? Well, the Colorado River may be griping against the National Park Service for allowing inflatable rafts to go down the river, which permit, let's say, people to get off and browse around the banks and trample down the flora along the banks and in this wise endanger the river's normal system. In my state of Wisconsin, we could have a suit, if he had his way, called the Wisconsin River versus Consolidated Papers. Now, the river's gripe in this case would be that the paper production processes of Consolidated Paper have, I'm not sure this is a legal term, grungified the river. And the river would be able to go to court and say, look, at time T0, let that be our baseline. Here's the kind of fish that roved the waters. Here's the kind of flora that lined the banks. Here's the oxygen level in the river at time T0, our point of departure time. Here's the depth of the river at time T0. And then a river would end up asserting that as a result of the pumping into the river of effluents from Consolidated Papers, we've had, for example, a die-off in fish population. We've had a decimation of the flora which lined the banks of the river. We've had siltation of the river. We've had eutrophication of the river. And the river is now claiming against Consolidated Papers, its case is that it demands a payment by Consolidated Papers to make it whole again. That is to say, to restore it as close as possible to the state it was before grungification began. and you can put a price tag on all this. You can ask, how much would it be to dredge the river? How much would it cost to aerate the river? How much would it cost to restock the river with fish? And so you can put a price tag on these kinds of things, and so you can cash it in terms of legal tender of what procedures would have to be made in order to have the river be made whole. Now all of this is an astonishing proposal. Because as we all know right now, and this is his point of departure, right now things like rivers and forests are rightless at law. I mean, they are not capable of functioning as plaintiffs. Our court system has not risen to the challenge of allowing these to have juror standing. So he's now going to give an argument as to why we should change our system so as to permit these kind of natural entities to have standing to sue against humans and agencies and organizations which do violence, do harm to these natural objects as the kind of objects they are. That's just all preliminary. Like a good attorney, I mean, there's a real methodical layout of this particular argument. It took him 60 pages to get it all out. And I'm going to see whether, you know, I can just lay out the fundamental structure of this argument for you without hopefully throwing away, you know, the baby away with the bathwater. And then we can talk about this proposal. It's seriously advanced. This is not frivolous. And there's lots of questions that we can entertain on multiple levels here, but they'll come up.
Does anyone take them seriously?
Yes, there have been blips on the screen in which people have tried to, some states or some attorneys try to file briefs on behalf of ecosystems and riverine communities and so forth. They have not been acknowledged by courts yet, but that hasn't dissuaded attorneys from trying it. I think one reason they're not discouraged is, you know, every idea has its gestation period. I won't go into it because I want to let him make the case. The title of the first chapter is Thinking the Unthinkable. And he starts off by rehearsing a line of argument which Charlie Darwin ran in his book called The Descent of Man. Darwin put forth a theory concerning human moral development. Darwin thought that back in the beginnings and the foggy beginnings of Homo sapiens and so forth, originally our early ancestors really cared only about moi. Maybe a small group of others, the woman that's living with you, your children, and so forth. But the kin of whose interests need to be considered was quite small. I mean, other families were off limits. I don't owe them anything. They have I don't have any duties toward them. They got no rights, or on and on. So we started there. And then we sort of march to where the groups of individuals that we thought we owed obligations to and who could bear rights against us continually widened it. You know, it became a tribe, maybe a city-state. If you fast forward the whole thing to the French Revolution, we're talking about every human being, no matter where they live, is having rights and so forth. So now we've included, you know, all humans. By this time, we've made up our mind that all humans can claim certain human rights. But then what happened? Well, it didn't stop there. The number of rightless humans, even under this advanced stage, still included as rightless people like prisoners, aliens, women, imbeciles, maimed people, other useless people. In time, they too were granted rights by law. Finally, we got to the point, according to Darwin, that human beings have ended up thinking that in actions which affect even animals, that it's not just that anything goes, that there are certain moral obligations resting upon us in our treatment of animals, maybe not to subject any of them to unnecessary pain or something. And so animals then came within the confines of those things that we thought we had moral obligations to. We have a continued widening of all this. Stone wants to point out that in the history of law, we'll just talk about the history of morals, there's been a parallel development. That more and more things which were at first rightless, disenfranchised, came to have rights. Let's just start back, for example, in ancient Rome, which had a pretty sophisticated legal system. I mean, it's interesting to look back on ancient Rome, because Roman fathers virtually had utterly dictatorial control over their children. I mean, the point is children had zippo rights against their fathers, even under Roman law. I mean, there were no laws limiting a father's form of discipline of the children. Beat the child into a coma. I mean, this wasn't legally wrong. Roman fathers could sell their children to other people. They could decide who their children's going to marry. If the marriage wasn't working out, they could dissolve the marriage. I mean, they had virtually dictatorial control. Well, obviously, we've seen the children obviously have come to have rights, and so we've come a long ways, baby, from ancient Rome. But think of all the things that have come to have rights since then. I listed some of these. Women, insane humans, fetuses, Indians. And here's where the plot begins to thicken for Stone, because he says almost invariably, every time somebody came up with a proposal to enfranchise with legal rights some entity which up to now didn't have it, almost always there was an invariable response that, and it amounted this way, something like this: "That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Why, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can't give rights to those things. I mean, you might as well give rights to TV sets or something. I mean, it's stupid. I mean, the complaint always initially was, well, that's just conceptually absurd. That can't be a rights bearer. I mean, it's stupid." What Stone would like to point out is that there are a lot of things that people pronounced, that's incredible. It doesn't make any sense to give rights to things like this, which the bottom line is they came to have rights. What kinds of things have rights now at law? That at first sight, when somebody proposes, you say, well, that's dumb. Trusts, corporations, railroads, ships, subchapter R contracts. I mean, here they are. The lawyer deals with them all the time. They've too come to have rights. And what he tries to point out, and he's just trying to grease the skids here, because he's going to make another one of these incredible proposals to give rights to something which you, upon first hearing, you say, well, that's just the stupidest thing I ever heard of. You can't do that. That's conceptually absurd. So he's just trying to set the stage for this. Almost every time, somebody proposed that some rightless object come to have legal rights, the standard first line of defense was, you can't do that because nature, now listen to this language, nature hasn't befit these things for rights. I mean, we have the appeal to something beyond us, namely nature has set limits as to what rights bearers can be. In pre-Civil War America, slaves were not persons. They had zero legal rights. Nothing. And There's a very interesting case which came out in, 1856. And this indicates the kind of unfolding story. Some slaveholder at the time declared in his will that upon his demise, his slave should have the choice of either being emancipated or sold at a public auction. They were given a choice. They would have ostensibly a right to choose their fate. Well, when the guy died and the will was being promulgated here, it went to court. And the court looked at this and just put the kibosh on it. In the same way, if a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old are married by the justice of the peace or something, come in and say, ha ha, mom and dad, you know, we're married. I mean, the law suddenly says, no, you can't do it. I mean, it's null and void. I don't care what you say. But that's what, in fact, the court said here. Listen to this decision. The court says, these decisions, you know, as to whether slaves can be free or choose their own fate, these decisions are legal conclusions following naturally and necessarily from the one clear, simple, fundamental idea of chattel slavery. The fundamental idea is that in the eye of the law, so far certainly as civil rights and relations are concerned, the slave is not a person, but a thing. This is the court. Investing a slave with civil rights or legal capacity is a legal ungrammaticality, an absurdity. To attribute legal personality to a slave, things like legal conscience, legal intellect, freedom, blah, 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 implies a palpable contradiction in terms. Case dismissed. The plot begins to thicken. In 1875, right in my home state of Wisconsin, there was a woman who wanted to practice law. At that time, you didn't need to go to law school to practice law. All you had to do was read law, you know, pass an exam or something. Well, this woman apparently had done all this, and now she proposes to be admitted to the bar. And the court, and it goes to court. And the court ends up saying, you can't do that. To grant you the legal right to, you know, practice law, you can't do this. Listen to how the court justified that. The court says, the law of nature destines and qualifies the female sex for the bearing and nurture of the children of our race and for the custody of the homes of the world. All lifelong callings of women that are inconsistent with these radical and sacred duties of their sex, as is the profession of law, are departures from the order of nature, and when voluntary, treason against nature. The peculiar qualities of womanhood, its gentle graces, its quick sensibility, its tender susceptibility, its purity. I know, put them all together, they spell mother. I mean, what the court says, the subordination of hard reason to sympathetic feeling are surely not qualifications for forensic strife. Nature has tempered woman as little for the juridical conflicts of the courtroom as for the physical conflicts of the battlefield. This case is dismissed. I mean, nature has set limits. Far be it from us to violate nature. Well, what Stone is trying to get you to see is, well, did women come to be able to practice law? Right. Well, we got one more lost cause. I mean, this appeal, you know, which says that you can't do that because nature has set certain boundaries, is just junk. So if you're inclined at first hearing to say, you can't give Rivers rights, I mean, that's anti-nature, well, maybe you ought to think twice and thrice about that, given this whole history. So he is seriously proposing that these kind of currently rightless entities be enfranchised with rights. I really hear Stone saying a rather interesting thing, that not only is it false that nature sets the limits as to what can have rights, but what is opposite is the case. A thing's got rights if we say it's got rights. I mean, I call this the Inspector 12 theory of rights grantor. I don't know if you guys remember that Hanes underwear commercial that ran for a while, and they had this tough-looking lady who stands at the end of the assembly line and stretches these Hanes shirts. And says, they don't say Hanes till I say they say Hanes, right? And if I say they say Hanes, they're Hanes. Well, I take it that that's Stone's view. If we say collectively they got rights, they got rights. Okay? If we want to grant rights to the rocks in Bryce Canyon that whose are being crumbling under the shocks from the jet planes going over, if we want to give rights to rocks, we give rights to rocks. Fine. I mean, you know, I mean, don't give me the stuff that, you know, that doesn't make any sense. If we say they got rights, they got rights. I mean, that's the way it is. That's the lesson we're supposed to learn. Well, he next walks us through what we're buying into if we go along with this. In good legal fashion, he sets forth a number of conditions that have to be fulfilled in order for it to be said truly within legalese that something called an X has got legal rights. And he gives four conditions. These are all necessary conditions for something having legal rights. First of all, you have to have something in a system, let's call it a court system, that's there lying in wait, able to judge as to whether some dirt has been done. I mean, you got to have something like that, a court system. But secondly, for something X to have legal rights, it's also got to be true that this thing X is able to institute legal proceedings at its request, its own request. That's tantamount to having what he calls legal standing. Thirdly, for something to have legal rights, it's also got to be true that when this court has reviewed X's case and is determining whether it should grant legal relief to X, and the legal relief could be some monetary award, a cease and desist order against somebody else, for X to have legal rights, it's got to be true that the court can take X's own injuries into account. And lastly, that the condition has to be fulfilled for something to have legal rights is that this legal relief granted by the court may run directly to X's personal benefit. Okay. Now, he makes a nice analogy. He says, consider two societies, both of which are slaveholding societies. Society S1, here's the way things work. It's slaveholding society. If Walter gets in an altercation with a slave I own and ends up doing physical violence to my slave and busts one of his arms. Now, in S1, it's not that the slave's injury is not taken into account at all, but here's the way things work in S1. The slave can't go to court and say, you know, I slave versus Keller. Okay? Can't do that. But the way it works in this society is that the slaveholder can be a plaintiff and can go to court and have Keller as a defendant saying, look, my own interests as a slaveholder have been harmed because I can't get as much work out of a guy with one arm than with two arms. So, you see, I'm the injured party. I mean, the slave's injury has redounded to my disbenefit, and you got to pay. That's what I'm... Okay, and suppose the court says, well, Peters, you're right. We see how his busting your slave there redounded to your disbenefit, and so we're going to assess against Keller some monetary award... which will somehow bring me back to where I would have been had not the incidents occurred. And notice that the court can only take my injuries into account here, not the slaves. The slaves are only indirectly, and that the legal relief when finally granted comes to me. fade to gray. Consider another society, S2, also slaveholding, where if you damage my slave, the slave can walk in and institute proceedings at his behest. Simply say, you injured me, and I want a monetary award for the damages done to me. Now, in this case, here we have the slave able to institute legal proceedings at his own behest, and in determining whether to grant any kind of legal relief, the court is looking at the slave's own injuries, and if it decides that an award should be made or something, then the award goes directly to the slave. I mean, now you see the difference between these two systems. In both systems, the slave's injury comes into cognizance, but directly in the second system and only indirectly in the first. Why are we walking through this? Stone says, if you look at the status of rivers, for example, and he uses this as a constant example, you can see that rivers, as objects that might be harmed, and we told you the kind of harms that rivers can get here, rivers are like those slaves in our first society, right? Who is it that can bring suit against Consolidated Papers, for example, with respect to the grungification of the Wisconsin River? Well, it's not the river. It's got to be somebody that attorneys call the lower riparian. You know, somebody that owns a property abutting the river that can come into court and simply say, look, I have been injured by the eutrophication of the river, the fish die off. It might be a motel owner. Okay, and he's got this wonderful motel. People used to come there and fish, and the kids used to swim. Now the kids can't swim. They got this algae all over the top. The fish have died off. It smells. He's losing business. The real estate values have gone down on his property and so forth. And so the gripe is his. So it would be the owner of the motel versus Consolidated Papers. Now, here's what Stone is pointing out, and he thinks this is an unfortunate situation. You can have all kind of hanky-pank go on between lower riparian plaintiffs and defendants. All kind of hanky-pank can go on, which would sell out the river's own interests. For example, I might be this motel owner, and start a suit with Consolidated Papers claiming all these economic damages, loss of business, diminishment of real estate value, on and on and on. And let's say that, I figure it's going to cost me maybe $10,000 in attorney's fees, you know, to fight this thing in court. The attorneys from Consolidated might come down to me and simply say, can we talk? It's going to cost us money, and you're asking for $20,000. Tell you what, if you won, you'd get $10,000. How about if we settle out of court for $11,000? Or maybe $8,000. And I might be taken with this proposal, and somebody say, okay, fine, I'll drop the case for some payoff. What happens to the river? Well, the grunge goes on, right? I mean, the river goes on being injured. Is anybody here to speak for the river? No, the only kind of spokespersons there can be are people who are indirectly affected. I mean, the lower riparians. And Stone thinks this is not proper. Because the environmental object itself, in this case the river, its interests are not taken into account. They never get into legal proceedings. Let's just waltz through some other kinds of questions. Somebody might see this proposal not arguing from natural limits to what can have rights, but come back and say, look, it's stupid to give these kind of natural entities like rivers rights because they can't talk. They can't plead their case in court. Well, just think about that for a minute. I mean, what's the attorney's answer going to be? Yeah, I mean, you know, attorneys speak as proxy voices for all kinds of things, corporations, trusts, infants, dead people. So, I mean, that's not a problem, a problem that can't speak. How would this thing work? Well, he says that this whole procedure could work by using existing mechanisms. Right now in law, especially the notion of guardianship, just an extension of the guardian. When somebody becomes mentally incompetent, or is not legally competent to make certain decisions, like very young children, or when your parents get senile and cannot conduct their economic affairs and so forth, court may appoint a guardian to operate. To speak for the party, to look out after their economic affairs, and so forth. So technically, we could have someone, maybe even an organization, operate as guardians who would speak on behalf of the interests of these natural objects. Who might they be? Well, they're going to come out of the woodwork. They're already there. The Sierra Club, the National Audubon Society, Environmental Defense Fund, Friends of Earth, Natural Resources Defense Council, the International Union of Conservancy of Nature, the Isaac Walden League. I mean, we're not going a-begging for outfits that are chafing at the bit to be able to represent these kinds of entities. And they've got tremendous legal staffs that are very literate and very gifted in arguing in this particular way. Well, how would this work? Suppose you have a guardian appointed for river, what would the guardian's rights and privileges be? Well, among other things, the guardian would have the rights of inspection of his ward. I mean, let's suppose some strip mining operation or something, dumping grunge or tailings or something on some natural surrounding here and so forth. I would have, as a guardian, the right of inspection. See whether harms are being done to, some natural valley or something in terms of the flora and fauna of the valley and so forth by the strip mining operator. I have the rights of inspection. I would have the right to represent my ward, let's say a river, at public hearings concerning water pollution laws. You know, I could speak on its behalf. And I would speak on its behalf in court if this thing materialized. Now, what would it mean? Well, what would happen if the Wisconsin River won this case against Consolidated Papers? Won a monetary award? Well, according to Stone, what would happen then is that the money would go into, my kingdom escapes the word. I want to say escrow, but that's not quite right. Trust fund, with the river's name on it. That would be administered by whoever is appointed to be the guardian. And these funds would be used to restore the entity to some baseline position. And then he goes on to say, one question that's going to be asked of him is, Why should we do this? Why should we grant rivers, take that as an example, legal rights? I mean, this is a heavy dude question. And Stone starts moving the microscope in on it and analyzing it and say, you know, that question sounds familiar to me. I mean, what's the question? Why should we humans, as exclusive rights bearers, give up our monopoly on legal rights and give such legal rights to inanimate objects or natural objects like rivers? He says, you know, that sounds strangely familiar because the white people ask, why should we? Why should we give up our exclusive monopoly on rights and give them to blacks? Males ask this when they were accosted with the possibility of females getting rights. Says, now why should we give up our exclusive rights status and enfranchise women? And someone says, now listen to the question. Why should we do this? Because the question is looking for a particular kind of answer, and the answer better well be that we're going to benefit by it. And indeed, to the question, well, why should we whites give up exclusive monopoly on rights and give them to slaves? Some people try to say, well, I think if we do, you'll get more work out of them. But Stone says, the correct answer to why women should have equal legal rights with men, vote, is because they deserve it. If the question is, what do we have to gain? What do we human beings have to gain by extending legal rights to these natural objects? His answer is, well, probably a lower standard of living, probably a lot more legally restrained behavior toward them. And of course, that's not the answer you want to hear. And what I think is interesting is when you start pressing ultimate questions to Stone, why should we do this? And you thumb through the book to try and find, how does he justify this? It's crystal clear the kind of justification he is not going to offer. He is not going to offer a justification that if we enfranchise these legal, these now rightless natural objects with rights, that somehow we humans are going to be better off. I mean, we already know he's not going to play that game. He's announced that's not the justification he's going to offer. Well then why? Why? And you page through the text here to find the answer to the why. And if you piece together the little nuggets where he seems to speak indirectly to this, I think the following is a fair interpretation. I think the ultimate reason that Stone thinks that we should grant legal rights to these objects is because they've got moral rights, which ought to be given the protection of law. Well, this simply moves the discussion back one. Moral rights. Why do they have moral rights? What is it about these entities which qualify them for moral rights? I mean, now we're asking a larger question than what it means to have legal rights. We're now asking the big question, I mean, what kind of conditions have to be fulfilled for it to be said in truth that something's got moral rights or a valid claim for moral rights, which then should be given the protection of law? Now, these are unanswered questions in Stone. But it strikes me that he can't get a persuaded public without walking the second and third mile and walking into this philosophical netherland. When I look around and ask, well, what is it about these natural objects that qualify them for moral rights? All you do is you get hints like this. He apparently thinks, now listen to this, that these objects have intrinsic value. Value in themselves. Such that to relate to them and treat them simply and only as instruments for the advancement of human welfare is to reduce them, is to treat them in a manner in which they are not. That they have value in themselves, and to turn something that has value in itself into a mere instrument or tool for the advancement of human interest is to fail to acknowledge and treat it with the respect owing something that has value in itself. And then he sort of kisses you off and suddenly say, take that. Well, I guess I want to hear more about this. Once I hear this from Stone, I'm reminded of, I don't know whether this is a true conversation that John Muir, you know, the founder of Sierra Club, once had with a group of snake shooters on a weekend snake shoot out in Arizona. I mean, back when Muir was living in the early part of the 20th century, Muir, I believe, used to go out to these rattlesnake shoots out in Arizona. So, I mean, you know, we got fish, you know, bass fishing contests, and we get prizes for the biggest bass or the most amount. Well, that's the way they used to do back then. I mean, you go out with your six gun out in the desert, and they get prizes, you know, for the biggest rattlesnake and the most numbers of rattlesnakes you bring back. And Muir apparently used to go out and stand as a one-man conscientious objector to this whole thing. And people sort of got miffed because he had this condescending attitude. And, you know, standing here said, why are you doing this? I don't understand why you're doing this. And finally somebody came up to him. I don't know whether this is a true story or merely apocryphal, but it's interesting. Somebody came up to him, reportedly, and says, well, John, what the hell good are rattlesnakes anyway? And his answer was, well, they're good for themselves. Well, before I go on, I have to tell you about a terrible moment in my teaching career. At the end of a class a number of years ago, I was about 5 minutes from the end, and some student asked this dynamite question, just probing. It was just a glorious question. And in order to even attempt an answer to this, what I had to do was try and extemporaneously recap a very convoluted argument. The last time I had been next to this argument was like 15 years ago, and I'm starting to run this argument. By the third sentence, I don't even understand what I'm saying. I mean, I mean, it's a big flog, and finally the bell rang. I said, oh, God, you know, saved by the bell. And the student came out to me afterwards and says, you know, that, I mean, I knew the student. He was a good student. And he says, you know, the argument that you were running at the end, says, I came to the conclusion that it must have been profound, because it sure as hell was obscure. I go back to John Muir's. I mean, what is it? You know, they have value in themselves. Is that profound or just obscure? You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it just sort of stops conversation, but I'm not sure we've advanced anything. So if I ask somebody, well, what do you mean by value in itself? You know what I typically get? What do you mean by it has intrinsic value? He said, well, I mean by that it has value in itself. I said, well, now I got another thing I don't understand. What do you mean it has value in itself? Well, I mean, it's got inherent value. Oh, I got three things I don't understand. I mean, what is this? It has value in itself. I mean, does this mean it would have value if nobody valued it? That seems incredible to me. I mean, I don't think anybody can have... How can a thing have value? Nobody values it. I mean, value is a conferred status, I would think. No value words, no valued objects. And he said, oh, that can't be the meaning. That's ridiculous. Well, now I'm asking a deeper question. Well, how would you know inherent value if you ran into it? I mean, what does it mean to have inherent value? And there have been a couple of answers to this. Now, what I'm trying to do here is that I think Stone needs help. Needs help. What do you think?
I agree.
And so we got to keep pushing this and say, come on, Chris, you know, cash it in. I don't understand this. This is just fog. Well, there's a guy named Tom Reagan. He's one arm of the animal liberation movement. And Reagan comes along and says, here, I'll rise to the challenge. Now, Reagan is a defender of animals and animal rights. If you go Reagan's way, we're going to get rid of trapping, we're going to get rid of sport hunting, we're going to get rid of animals used for food, we're going to get rid of animals used as experimental objects, we're going to get rid of animals in zoos. I mean, everything goes down the toilet. I mean, if you buy Reagan. Now, why is it... I mean, he wants to say that all these methods I've just enumerated are ways that in which us humans treat animals as just things, as just instrument or tools for the gratification of human interest, and he wants to say that's the fundamental wrong because they've got value in their own right. Well, how does he cash this in? He says, well, here's what I mean. Every organism, I mean, every animal is a being which is what he calls a subject of a life which can be better or worse for it. An animal, let's say minimally, can feel pleasure, pain, and if you watch the conduct of a normal animal, it typically goes to the pleasure side and tries to avoid the pain. I mean, arguably, you've got something that can discern the difference between life going well for it or poorly for it. Yeah? Well, Reagan then wants to say, well, it's not far out to say that even though this animal doesn't possess language, you can't linguicize this, it values its own life. I mean, a whole behavior repertoire shows that it does. So, here we go. It values its own life. Here we go. Now back up. Even if no one else valued that life, it would still have value in itself because it values its own life. Ah, I guess I understand this. There's one sense of inherent value. It depends on consciousness. You understand it? Is this going to help Stone? I don't think so. Because I take it that trees aren't conscious. Now, I know that Cleve Baxter used to go on Johnny Carson all the time. Remember him? He's the guy that came out and thought that plants feel. And Johnny would introduce that. Here comes Cleve Baxter, and there'd be a big plant on Johnny's platform, see? And a camera would move in on this plant, and Cleve Baxter would come out from underneath the curtains. And there was a galvanometer, which measured electrical resistance, was hooked to the leaves of these plants. And this guy comes on stage and goes, I mean, this Neil just went wild. Like, why is the plant doing this? Well, it recognizes Cleve Baxter. Just prior to the show, Cleve had taken a cigarette lighter and burned three of the leaves. And now the argument is that the plant sees, recognizes. I just find this very difficult. I mean, I don't think that plants are like animals and are subject of lives, and so plants can't, and much less rivers, and whole ecosystems, can't be the kind of things that can have intrinsic value in the sense that Tom Reagan wants to get intrinsic value going for animals, if you follow. So Stone is still in trouble. Still in trouble. Because plants just can't have intrinsic value. Ecosystems can't have intrinsic value because that all depends on being sentient, capable of feeling pleasure or pain, or at least mentally being conscious. Now, so that's not going to do it. Now, there's some philosophers come along and says, I got the answer. Here's what Stone needs. Here's what Stone needs. That will include plants in this. Let me start small, build to a big finish, you know, so you can see where these guys are going. Can't you, I mean, just take a look at house plants. Can't you tell the difference between a flourishing rhododendron and a languishing one? Yeah, I mean, and plant pathologists and botanists can do this all the time. Of course they can. I mean, we've got so many sick plants around our house, we're just always going down to the hardware store and trying to find, Jesus, what disease, you know, is, I've got stippled leaves and all this kind of stuff. I mean, right, you and I can instantly recognize that plant pathologists with more acuity can recognize the distinction between a flourishing tulip and a languishing one, or a flourishing ponderosa pine tree and a languishing one. All right? That's an important beachhead in this argument. Because Reagan's analysis of intrinsic value presupposes that the animals are interested in certain states of affairs to go well for them as the kind of entity they are. But you know, in English, we talk about people being interested in certain things, but we also have another notion of interest, that something can be in the interests of something. I might be interested in smoking two packs a day, but arguably it's not in my interests to do so. The latter sense of interest has to do with welfare. It's not in my welfare. It's not conducive to my long-term welfare to smoke 2 packs a day. So we got 2 cents of interest. Okay? Watch your code. Now these new philosophers end up saying, look, we can talk very sanely about certain things being conducive to the faring well of plants and things conducive to the ill faring. We know, for example, that ozone, which is part of the photochemical smog, which cars contribute to every day along the California freeways, we have alongside of some of these freeways national forests with ponderosa and Jeffrey pine trees. And, I mean, they're just dying. I mean, we know why they're dying. I can say that ozone is not conducive to the interests of ponderosa pines, and you understand what I mean. In other words, we can identify flourishing members of the type that it is. Flourishing pumas, flourishing tigers, even flourishing viruses, I suppose. I mean, you know, we can do this. So we talk about a state of faring well, which is the bullseye or the zenith of all of these. And we know that we can do things to screw up their interests in this latter sense of interest and make them go down the tube. This is interesting, because it would seem as though to the extent that we're prepared to admit that we can itemize the indices of the criteria for a state of flourishing, even for a plant, that we can say, well, that's a good rhododendron. That rhododendra have a good of their own, that I can list the criteria for identifying this good. Now listen to this, a good of their own. In other words, it's a good. Even if we didn't value the faring well of bull weevils or mosquitoes, I can still objectively define the criteria of faring well for the kind of entity that it is. It's got a good of its own. Now listen to the language. If it's got a good of its own, you've already gotten the magic word in. It's good. If something's good, you automatically have a moral burden of proof as to why you're going to do anything to muck it up. Now, maybe this is what Stone needs. Maybe this is what Stone needs. Because the next thing is, since you see where he really wants to go, is he wants to even be able to enfranchise total ecosystems as possible plaintiffs. Can we talk sanely about what is good for total assemblies of plants and animals? What is good for a beech maple forest, a savanna? Can we? Now this is where my ecology gets away from me. But I think some ecologists say, yeah, we can. There are certain things that contribute to the, I'm sounding like Aldo Leopold, the integrity, the stability, the beauty, and other things which don't. But we're talking about systemic features. Now maybe Stone can affirm that these things have intrinsic value in this latter sense, that they have a good of their own whose indices or criteria are capable of being specified objectively, and if it's a good of their own, now we can see why there's some moral burden to show just cause as to why it is that we're going to do something that screws up this good. Now maybe that's the theory that he needs. Let's just leave it off right there. I've sort of brought you to a plateau. We've done both the legal analysis and a little bit of philosophy. What are your reactions to this proposal?
Okay. We buy into the whole idea. Rocks have rights too. However, we're not really empowering that rock when you think about it. What we're doing is empowering another group of humans to take the rights of that rock and sue for them. Now we're assuming that that group of people that we have empowered are going to do the right thing for the rock. Okay, they're going to sue for the rock. They're going to watch out. But are they also going to take bribes not to sue for the rock? Or if they sue for the rock and they get that trust fund, what kind of administrative fees will come out of that trust fund before they start doing good for that rock? We haven't empowered that rock. We've just empowered another group of humans.
Human beings to speak on its behalf, and they can be sold out.
That's right.
I'm almost thinking that complaint is probably purely general. If we enfranchise me, if the law enfranchises me to speak on behalf of my senile mother as her guardian, I can do all kinds of things to self. So the problem is purely general. It doesn't infect just this proposal. So what are we supposed to say? Well, given the fact, I mean, we shouldn't allow guardians. The state, I mean, any guardian can be prostituted. I mean, I don't know what
we want to do. Well, there would have to be certain controls.
Yeah, there would have to be safeguards on that.
How do you think we should do that? Is there some way, just to save the hypothesis, save the procedure, some way we can make sure that these people play clean, or we just trust them because, after all, they're Sierra Clubbers? I mean,
you're assuming that most of the overseers are going to be attorneys and lawyers to start with, who are going to distribute the funds. So you can
write off half of it, right?
You can write a third to half of it right off the bat. And that's not forgiven. Whereas you, as a guardian over your parent, you will not have that opportunity to do that. And you will be closely scrutinized also.
How can you not have a lawyer?
But what's to say that if the Sierra Club represents an ecosystem, mm-hmm. and then say they do something corrupt with it over a period of time, then what's to say that they're the sole guardian of this ecosystem?
Yeah, why did the Audubon Society came in?
Right.
Your Honor, I call for dismissal of the guardianship. You know, they sold them out. Why can't we have the right to challenge? Is that what you're suggesting?
Right.
Good move.
Well, certainly some other relative of your mother could challenge you for the guardianship.
All right. So we're arguing from precedent.
Yeah.
Good move.
I think one of the things that I thought of that even has a bearing on this argument is that you talk about things in its own right, but things interact and their rights differ. In other words, the little fish has a right to live and eat, but the bigger fish has the right to eat the little fish in order for it to mm-hmm. maintain its goodness. And the same thing, the river has a right to flow, and it impinges upon the rock's right to stay where it is and moves it down. So you get a definition of whose right takes precedence over.
Viruses have a right to grow, so we wipe out penicillin.
Right.
Okay.
And it's the same thing, you know.
Floods.
Yeah.
And impinges on the rights of the farmer or the city dweller whose house is being flooded by the river.
Okay, so if we're gonna have rivers as plaintiffs, why not rivers as defendants? I mean, right? Okay.
Now you get the Cowlitz River suing Mount St. Helens.
Okay, let me read you. You guys have been watching too much. Been watching too much L.A. Law here. Stone, I mean, you know, you don't get an endowed chair at the University of Southern California Law School if you're, you know, a ninny. So let me read you a couple of purple paragraphs in which he understands that this kind of thing is going to be forthcoming. Now, you can decide whether you like this rejoinder. He said, it's true that there's a labyrinth of problems that we could become lost in here. Which natural objects are we going to countenance as persons? The ecology of a bay? The oyster bed on the floor? Each oyster? If a guardianship can be established over a forest, someone may ask, why not over an earthworm? Are we to concern ourselves with a watershed, a tributary, or a river? Suppose a guardian is appointed by a county court with respect to a stream, and a federal court appoints a guardian, with different ideas, for the larger river basin system of which the stream is a part. Well, one can spin off a myriad of complicated scenarios, all with an eye toward frightening the law away from the guardianship idea. Court calendars clog to a halt with trivia. Endless jurisdictional disputes with a guardian for one entity, setting himself at odds with a guardian for another and the like. But to my mind, here comes the answer. No one sympathetic to the environment should be put off because somewhere far on the other side of this new legal territory there may lie some mountains we don't now know how to cross. They may be molehills when we get there. Whatever hypotheticals we can conjure up in the classroom or at Holden Village, no lawyer I know in the real world is about to invest his time going to court to ask...